scene of the crime, help in the manhunt, even to watch the funeral and visit the victim's grave. The memorial services for Cutter's previous victims had been very private affairs, too risky for a stranger to drop in unnoticed. Tyler's was very different. If it wasn't his psychological makeup at all, Cutter would make his appearance here. Victoria stepped away from the crowd and found a spot behind a stand of white mums and daisies where she checked in with local police who were monitoring the parking lot. She wasn't mic'd up, but text messaging was a less conspicuous way to communicate with a uniformed officer in the setting. "Anything?" she texted. A reply came in less than a minute. "Keep an eye on the guy with the cheap blue suit on the Converse All-Stars. Looks a little suspicious." Victoria had already checked him out. He was the somewhat eccentric head of BB&L's commercial litigation department, one of the top-ranked trial lawyers in America, known for showing up in court wearing wrinkled suits and sneakers. It was part of his jury appeal. "Know him. Not a POI," she texted back. The immediate family took their places in the front row. Most of the guests had found seats, and latecomers were filling in the few random openings. It was standing room only, and Victoria made one last pass through the parlor, pretending to be looking for a seat near someone she knew, hunting for a killer she was dying to know. Her search led her to the back of the room. No suspects. She stepped into the lobby and checked for any messages from the officers. Nothing. The parlor doors were closed, and she was the lone guest in the lobby as the speaker in the ceiling crackled with the voice of a minister. "The Lord be with you," he said in a solemn voice. Victoria prayed with them, albeit from the next room, but she stepped outside before the first eulogy. The temperature had dropped since sunset, and the cool night air was refreshing. The area around the funeral home felt more residential than commercial, and many of the nearby businesses were on large lots, formerly single-family homes. It was a moonless night, and the dense canopy of broad-limbed oaks and sprawling poinciana trees turned the neighborhood into a dark suburban forest. Hundreds of parked cars lined the street, but the police were redirecting traffic at the intersections on either end, so it was completely quiet. Eerily quiet. Victoria stepped to the porch railing and looked out into the darkness, taking it all in. A young couple came running up the sidewalk, obviously late. Victoria opened the door and let them pass. Other than the squad car monitoring the main lot, there was little else to take note of. The occasional rustle of leaves in the breeze, a distant chorus of crickets, and a tiny glowing orange dot in the overflow parking lot across the street. "What is that?" She narrowed her eyes, straining for a better look. The orange dot was still there, but ever so slightly it seemed to have moved. Someone was standing there smoking. Jeffrey Dahmer had been a chain smoker. So had many of the other serial killers she'd studied and even profiled. Victoria texted one of the officers outside, alerting him to check out the orange dot. But before she could hit send, the orange dot disappeared. Shit. Victoria hurried down the steps and ran straight to the officer in the parking lot. No one wanted a scene at Tyler's memorial service, but Victoria had to trust her own instincts. Several squad cars were in the area for traffic control, but she'd heard no engine start and seen no car lights after the cigarette was extinguished. She grabbed the officer's radio and sent the best be-on-the-lookout alert that she could articulate. "Intercept subject on foot leaving Seaver's overflow lot. No ideas yet. Definitely a smoker, so may smell of cigarettes or have them on his person." "A smoker?" the cop beside her asked. "That's all you got?" "That's all we'll ever have if you don't help. Fan out." Victoria kept his radio, drew her weapon, and ran across the street into the overflow lot. The officer swept to the left, approaching the lot from another street entrance. One of the squad cars from traffic control pulled up, beacons flashing. A pair of officers jumped out. One switched on the spotlight and scanned the overflow lot, while the other checked between rows of parked vehicles, his gun drawn. In a sea of cars, law enforcement was the only sign of movement. one of the officers circled back to Victoria and asked, "What did you see exactly?" "Someone smoking a cigarette standing right around here, watching." This officer had some seniority, and he seemed to grasp the significance of a man standing in the dark and watching a young woman's funeral from across the street. He keyed his radio and reiterated Victoria's earlier message. Victoria breathed deep, appreciating the officer's follow-through, but knowing that the window of opportunity was closing. The orange dot had vanished. So had the smoker. There wasn't much to go on. At this point, unless the guy was stupid enough to be caught running down the street with a lit cigarette in his hand, no amount of perimeter control in the neighborhood was likely to be of help. "Check this out," another officer said. He was down on one knee, his flashlight illuminating a black patch of asphalt behind a parked car. Victoria knelt for a closer look. Sprinkled across the ground were traces of ash, the droppings from someone's cigarette. Ashes wouldn't yield DNA from saliva or anything else she could work with, but there was hope. "Check for cigarette butts everywhere, the whole parking lot." She rose slowly, gazing across the street toward the packed funeral home. "One mistake, that's all it takes, and we find this guy." Chapter 22. Brian Belter peered out the helicopter window, the black Atlantic below him, the South Florida Gold Coast on the western horizon, a continuous blur of lights from Miami to Palm Beach. Belter was in his usual leather cabin seat of a Eurocopter EC-225 Super Puma helicopter. It was the fastest of three helicopters used by the lawyers for Cortina Sugar, big enough to transport an entire trial team at speeds up to 170 miles per hour above the South Florida gridlock. Tonight, it was just Belter and a trusted associate, the only BB&L lawyers not attending Tyler's memorial service in the spacious cabin, even though it had been Belter's full intention to deliver the eulogy. He'd massaged the draft for hours, choosing just the right words, striking exactly the right tone, touching precisely the right emotions. Of course, he had run it by Alberto Cortinas well in advance. "Nice," Cortinas had told him. "Get someone else to deliver it."
"Why?"
"I need you in the Dominican Republic tonight. Take the helicopter to Palm Beach. The jet leaves for La Romana at 7.
That had been the end of the matter.
Brian Belter would miss Tyler Tompkins' memorial service, which was no big deal in the larger scheme of things. Belter had missed countless funerals and weddings over the years, missed his wife's 40th birthday celebration, missed the 45th birthday celebration that she had planned for him, missed the births of both their children, missed saying goodbye to his mother on her deathbed, and yes, even missed her memorial service. All for one good reason. Because Alberto Cortinas needed him. The chopper touched down gently on the helipad at Palm Beach County International Airport. Belter's associate reached across the narrow aisle and handed him the phone. The pilot was powering down the Eurocopter, and the roar of twin engines was quickly cut in half, making it unnecessary to use headsets or even raise their voices when talking.
"I have Mr. Cortinas on the line,"
his associate said. Belter took the call. Immediately, he could hear that Cortinas was not happy.
"I just saw an email from Maggie Green," said Cortinas. "What the hell is this nonsense about a subpoena?"
Belter signaled to the younger lawyer that he needed to be alone. An ejection seat couldn't have popped her from the cabin any faster.
"The subpoena was inevitable,"
he said into the phone.
"So is death. That doesn't make it pleasant.
What right does the government have to review Tyler's emails and computer records at your law firm?"
"Tyler's the victim of a homicide. The FBI is coordinating the investigation. They're being thorough."
"Bullshit. The FBI is charging ahead with a subpoena before the state attorney is even on board, and I know exactly what this is about. This is shades of the Clinton administration when that U.S. attorney down in Miami sued the state of Florida for failing to enforce environmental regulations against us.
Don't ever forget history, Brian.
The feds have been aching to bring criminal charges against the sugar companies since their slavery indictment got tossed out of court in 1941. They're using Tyler's murder as an excuse to go on a fishing expedition, dredge up anything they can find. Frankly, there's probably plenty to sink their teeth into in Tyler's files. And you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Belter did. We'll make sure that doesn't happen.
How?
Maggie is on it, said Belter. Our position will be that everything is protected by the attorney-client privilege. The government can't have it.
That's lame, Cortina said, scoffing. It's not enough to say they can't have it. Before we even get into that fight, we need to know exactly what's in there. I don't want any more surprises like your phone number turning up on Tyler's prepaid phone.
Mere mention of it made Belter cringe. I hear you.
I'm going to send in a couple of my IT guys to search Tyler's computers.
When?
Tonight.
Belter glanced out the window toward the corporate jet on the runway. The helicopter just landed. I'm about to leave for La Romana.
I know. Unfortunately, you've been called away on business out of the country and are unable to supervise this process. Of course, it would be a shame if some of Tyler's files or emails were inadvertently deleted. But I trust these men will do their very best.
The helicopter engine shut down completely, and the whirring blades overhead faded into silence. Belter shifted uncomfortably but said nothing.
Brian, do you hear what I'm saying?
Belter cleared his throat, then spoke in a firm voice. We need to be very careful here. Depending on how this investigation plays out, a court could order an independent expert to examine our computer system and determine if any of Tyler's files were deleted after her death. That would be a very simple analysis for any tech expert, and it would be very difficult for us to explain. My law firm has been served with a court-issued subpoena. There are criminal penalties for spoliation of evidence.
I'm not worried about that.
You need to be. I'm not just talking about corporate fines and a slap on the wrist. There could be jail time for anyone involved.
Understood. But here's the thing, Brian. I'm not involved.
Belter was silent.
Isn't that right, Brian?
Belter still did not reply.
Brian, I didn't hear you.
Yeah, he said in a clipped voice.
Yeah, what?
That's exactly right. You're not involved.
I'll send the driver to pick you up when the plane lands in La Romana. See you in a couple hours.
Sure thing, said Belter. See you then. Chapter 23. I joined Carmen for dinner after the memorial service. She picked the restaurant, a trendy place north of downtown in the design district called, of all things, Sugarcane. I hadn't eaten since lunch and I was starving, but I had too much on my mind to enjoy the food, which was served tapas style. I basically drank while Carmen gushed about the crispy Florida frog legs potato puree with salsa verde, surpassed only by the duck and waffle crispy leg confit. I nibbled on a honey-glazed spare rib between beers, and Carmen cut me off after two bottles of some import that provided much more kick than the typical American brew. The last thing the state attorney needed was for one of her senior trial counsel to be pulled over for drunk driving. I was home before 11. Angelina was still out. I was tired and wanted to go to bed, but I had to wonder if my claim to half the mattress had been at least temporarily suspended. I got another beer from the refrigerator, plopped on the couch in front of the television, and channel surfed for a while. The bottle was empty, and I was nodding off when the front door opened. Angelina was by herself, which came as a relief. I was deep enough in the doghouse without her mother's involvement.
How's your mom?
Fine. That four-letter word again.
Angelina left her keys in the dish by the door and crossed the room behind me. We're doing a spa tomorrow, so you should make plans. I already had plans to go back to Belglade. That's cool. She stopped. What does that mean? What does what mean? That's cool. Who talks to his wife like that? I'm not one of your buddies. Who have you been hanging out with all day, JT? Sometimes I could have sworn that Angelina had ESP. Are we circling back to JT now? Really? A look of surprise came over her, followed by a knowing expression that marked the realization that she was onto something. You did go see him, didn't you? I took him to visit Luther at the nursing home. She dropped her purse on the cocktail table, stood between me and the television, and looked straight at me. We might as well discuss this now. Mom and I had a talk. Oh, boy. Don't roll your eyes, Abe. I didn't. At least I didn't think so. This JT nonsense has to stop. I'm tired of you taking care of him. I'm tired of you going back to where you used to live. Tired of you looking after Luther. Tired of the whole stupid extended family thing. I can't just cut them off. Why not? Because JT will end up living under a bridge again. That's not our problem, Abe. He's my brother-in-law. He scares me, okay? There is nothing to be scared of, Abe. He kissed me on the mouth in our own house last Thanksgiving. We've been over this, Angelina. JT did not kiss you on the mouth. I saw the whole thing. He went to kiss you on the cheek and you turned your head. That's not how it happened. That's exactly how it happened, Abe. This is the kind of thing that families don't talk about, and they put up with it, and they pretend nothing's wrong, until one day it ends up on the 6 o'clock news because some crazed family member shows up at Christmas dinner with a semi-automatic pistol and blows everyone away. I've talked to JT's psychiatrist. He's not violent. I don't want to take that risk, okay? 2 days ago, we talked about starting our own family, though frankly, the thought of having sex with you right now is not at the top of my list, but whatever. No sane mother would want JT around her child. You need to tell him he's not welcome here anymore. I looked away, but I couldn't say that she was entirely wrong. All right, JT doesn't visit our house anymore. I don't want you going over there either. I don't want you to have anything to do with him. It's not that simple. Make it simple, Abe. This has gone on too long. I've tried to be understanding, and as complicated and confusing as this may sound, I truly feel sorry that your wife died. I know it seems like I've turned into a nag, but I just can't take it any... My focus drifted past her toward the image on the flat screen. The volume was low, but the lead story on the 11 o'clock news was the memorial service for prominent Miami attorney Tyler Tompkins. Angelina turned and followed my gaze to the screen. Her annoyance that I had looked away from the conversation quickly turned to anger. There, on television, was me, alongside the state attorney, walking into the funeral home. Angelina looked at me in disbelief. You went to that woman's memorial service? Carmen asked me to go with her. And you couldn't say no? She's my boss. I'm your wife. Do you have no respect for me at all? You're making way too much of this. She glared at me like she'd never glared before. I wasn't sure if she was about to burst into tears or erupt in a rage. Get out, Abe. What? She wasn't screaming, but she was on the verge. She came to me, grabbed me by the arm, pulling me from the couch. Just get out! Go stay with JT! Angelina, please. Go! T tears were beginning to flow.
"Please don't,"
I started to say, but she was pulling me toward the door and screaming,
"Go, Abe! Just get the hell out!"
She was so loud that I was afraid the neighbors might hear, not to mention one of the extra MDPD officers who had been patrolling our neighborhood since Thursday night and the arrival of those photographs of Tyler and me.
"Get out!"
Angelina pulled me across the room and yanked open the front door. I grabbed my keys as she literally pushed me out, and the door slammed behind me. I stood outside in the porch for a minute, debating whether I should actually leave. I heard my empty beer bottle smash against the door, a direct hit from across the room, which was confirmation enough. I walked slowly across the lawn to my car in the driveway, got inside, and started the engine. I didn't want to leave, but I didn't blame Angelina. The steering wheel was the closest target available, and I pounded it so hard that I thought I'd broken my fist. "Idiot," I shouted. And it had nothing to do with my throbbing hand. The porch light went out, and the front window went dark. Angelina's final punctuation mark. I backed out of our driveway and drove away, not sure where I was headed. Chapter 24. I ended up at JT's apartment. JT had his definite downside, but one thing that could be counted on was that if ever you showed up at his door at midnight after an argument with your wife, not a word of it would end up on Facebook, Twitter, or any other social media. He didn't do any of it. I assured him that nothing was wrong, but even someone as self-centered as JT could see the worry lines etched on my face. "Did you and Angelina have a fight?" "No."
"Was it about me?"
Everybody but me had ESP, and I was getting tired of it.
"I just need a place to sleep."
His interrogation continued, and finally my only exit was to close my eyes and pretend to fall asleep on the couch. He was a late sleeper on his medication, and I made a point of leaving the next morning long before he woke. Belle Glade was a 90-minute drive north, and I didn't have to stop by my house to freshen up. Not to prove Angelina's point, but emergency overnighters at JT's apartment had become so commonplace that I kept clean clothes and a toothbrush there. I reached the Farm Aid office by 9:30. Ed drove from there. After such a horrendous week, I must have been desperate for comic relief, because it struck me as the funniest thing on earth that Ed actually owned an old Volkswagen bus. And I just couldn't stop laughing.
"What's so funny?"
I got control of myself.
"Nothing."
"Shaggy." I burst out laughing again. We drove west out of the town of Belle Glade for about 10 minutes until we had to stop at a railroad crossing deep in the middle of cane-covered farmland. An endless string of rail cars passed before my eyes, brimming with mounds of freshly cut cane stalks heading for the grinding mill.
600,000 tons of cane every cutting season, said Ed. And that's just Cortinas.
How much sugar comes out of that?
A shitload. And with the artificial price supports from Uncle Sam, they sell it wholesale at a guaranteed minimum of 22 cents a pound, compared to about 8 cents for sugar grown in other countries. Big sugar will spit in your eye and call your mother dirty names if you ever utter the words corporate welfare. But if you add it all up across the industry, the sugar subsidy puts an extra $2.5 billion on the backs of American consumers each year.
Ed had an assortment of rants against the sugar industry, each packaged separately and as neatly as the pink, blue, and yellow sugar substitutes on the coffee bar.
Sounds like your next lawsuit, I said.
Don't get me started.
The end of the train finally passed and the warning light stopped flashing. The old van rocked over the rough crossing, but the next 10 miles on the other side of the tracks looked exactly like the previous 10. The Cortinas family owned 12% of all the land in Palm Beach County, about 155,000 acres, not counting Alberto's $20 million Mediterranean-style estate on the island of Palm Beach. Neat rows of cane sprouted from the rich bed of black soil that the slow flow of the Everglades had deposited over the last 100,000 years, most of it decayed sawgrass. Here on Cortina's land, the waters flowed no more, except in the rainy season, when the runoff of phosphates and other pollutants from the drained wetlands found their way into the waterways and canals and became someone else's problem. Ed slowed the van, and we stopped on the gravel shoulder of the road. It seemed to be no place special. Sugarcane fields to the south, the mirror image to the north.
"We're here," he said.
"Where is here?" Ed reached across to the glove compartment, removed a yellowed newspaper, and handed it to me. It was the front page of the Palm Beach Post, dated January 17, 1986. Car crash kills state rep. Read the headline below the fold. The first paragraph told me why Ed had brought me to the spot. State Representative Marshall Conrad, Democrat Sebring, died in a single car crash 12 miles west of Belglade. The charred remains of his vehicle were found early Wednesday in a cane field. The field was undergoing a controlled burn late Tuesday night in preparation for harvesting, and workers for the Cortina Sugar Company discovered the vehicle the next morning. Florida Highway Patrol reports that there were no known witnesses and that the accident is under investigation. I skimmed the rest of the story, but it was mostly a discussion of the victim's record for fiscal conservatism as a state legislator and his plans to run for Congress in the upcoming fall election. Nothing further about the crash. So, what happened?
You just read it.
I flicked the newspaper with my finger. This hardly tells me anything. Ed smiled and shook his head. Welcome to the Cortinas world of privacy, power, and influence. Not another detail was ever released to the public. There must have been a police report, I said.
Sealed.
Medical examiner's report?
Sealed.
Investigative file?
Sealed.
Why?
Good question. This guy Conrad was a rising star in Florida politics. Not much help on the Everglades, but he hated Big Sugar on pure economics. He was gearing up to run a congressional campaign that would lay out the incumbent as the sugar industry's boy, a puppet on Capitol Hill who lines the pockets of the Cortinas family with artificial price supports from the federal government.
Now I understood his corporate welfare rant as we'd watched the train pass.
So you're serious?
There's no public account of how this happened?
None.
I checked the masthead one more time, noting the year. 1986.
The same year that Vernon Gallagher ended his cane-cutting career.
So you're thinking what?
Oh, I don't know, said Ed playfully. A rising star in Florida politics dies in a fiery crash in a Cortinas cane field before he can challenge the sugar industry's biggest supporter in Congress. And within months, the Michael Phelps of cane cutting hangs up his machete. Coincidence or not?
I took his meaning. The implication meaning that Vernon Gallagher was out in the field and knows something about the accident.
Yep, said Ed.
Like maybe the accident was no accident.
A homicide, I said, which has no statute of limitations.
Which Tyler Tompkins would have reason to bring to your attention all these years later.
I glanced out the passenger side window toward the thick cane field, then back at Ed. We're getting way ahead of ourselves here.
Yeah, I know.
Ed restarted the engine. The good news is that our next trip should be much more interesting.
Next trip?
He said. Jamaica.
Excellent! You're going to Jamaica?
No. We are, I said. Time for a little talk with Vernon Gallagher. I called Angelina on the drive back from Palm Beach County. She didn't answer, and I decided not to leave a message. Little more than 12 hours had passed since she'd thrown me out of the house. If she wasn't ready to talk, pushing her wasn't going to help. I was cruising down the turnpike south of Kane Country, but my thoughts drifted back to the Cortinas family. I was trying not to run too fast with Ed's theory about 1986. He was, after all, the pony-tailed crusader who had taken on the sugar industry in a 12-year legal battle with nothing to show for it but an office full of archive boxes and 10,000 Jamaicans out of work. But a day trip to Kingston wasn't a huge investment on my part, and if we could actually find Vernon Gallagher, the payoff could be huge, and not just from the standpoint of law enforcement. If Tyler's phone calls to me did in fact prove to be a genuine crime tip, it might soften some of Angelina's anger over my decision to attend the memorial service with Carmen. Of course, there were still the dinner photographs from Orlando. For that, I would simply have to beg for Angelina's forgiveness. Flowers? But not a bouquet. I could send her one long-stemmed rose at a time. The first time we'd moved in together, I'd told Angelina to choose her side of the walk-in closet, select the dresser drawer she wanted, and mark off the Angelina-only section of the shared master bathroom. After she fell asleep, I got up and placed a single red rose in each drawer, each cabinet, and every space she'd chosen, so that she'd find them when she woke. We'd both missed work that morning. That would evoke a nice memory. Or would it? It occurred to me that I was again reaching back to the pre-Samantha days of Abe and Angelina. My cell rang through the Bluetooth. I checked the digital display on the dashboard, which alerted me to two facts, that I was doing 85, and that the call was from a New York area code. My hope was that Angelina was calling me on her mother's phone. I cut my speed and answered on speaker. It was my mother-in-law. Abe, do you know where Angelina is? It was a strange question, not because I didn't know the answer, but because they were supposed to be at the spa together. No, I've been in Palm Beach all day.
When's the last time you saw her?
The strangeness was giving way to a certain urgency in her voice. Is everything okay?
Yes, no. I mean, I don't know. When did you see her last?
Just before midnight? I spent the night at JT's apartment. Margaret, what is going on?
We were supposed to meet at my hotel 2 hours ago. Angelina never showed up. I've been calling her on her cell and no one answers.
I tried too, I said.
Has anyone gone by the house? Yes, I'm standing on the front porch right now. That's what has me so worried. Her car is here in the driveway, but no one answers the door.
It was premature for this to be a missing person case under normal protocol, but those photographs she'd received, possibly from a serial killer, changed everything. Margaret, I want you to stay calm, okay? There have been extra patrol cars in our neighborhood since Thursday night.
Oh my God, Abe. What is going on?
Help will be there soon, I told her. I'm going to hang up and dial 911 right now. Chapter 25. I felt like a switchboard operator on the ride home, dialing numbers, taking callbacks, making follow-ups. My first call was to Carmen, who got right on it, and then to Rid. 2 minutes later, Carmen called back to let me know that a pair of first responders had forced their way into our house. The good news was that the police hadn't found Angelina hurt, or worse.
The concern is that no one knows where she is, said Carmen.
What about the extra patrol officers in our neighborhood? Did any of them see her come or go from the house?
No.
I recalled my drive home Thursday night when I'd spotted the extra officer sitting in a squad car texting. Is Angelina's car still in the driveway?
Yeah, that's one of the confusing things.
She's a jogger. Did anyone see her out running this morning?
No, Abe. But they're interviewing neighbors as we speak. We agreed that the FBI should be involved. Santos had made her mark at the Bureau as a pioneer of what was then known as the Child Abduction and Serial Killer Unit. Despite the recent tension between Santos and me, it seemed like a godsend that she was at our disposal. Even so, my next call was to Ridd, who conferenced in the other MDPD lieutenant overseeing the investigation, which was centered at my house. I shared everything I thought it was important for them to know about Angelina's habits, hangouts, and friends. Explaining why I hadn't been home with my wife last night was awkward, but I had to get everyone to move past it. You guys need to keep checking the neighborhood, checking her phone, her iPad. There must be something. We're on it, said Ridd. I wanted to be right on the scene, but I fully trusted that Ridd was indeed on it. I knew that every neighbor in the area would be interviewed, every emergency room in the county contacted, and that everything from Angelina's cell phone to her Facebook page would be tracked and monitored. Any activity on her credit cards would be an immediate red flag. But I needed to do something. I had only a mental list of names for Angelina's girlfriends and co-workers. Dialing 411 was something I could do from my car, and I called everyone I could think of. Some were good friends who could be trusted to act responsibly, but some of the names that came to mind were fringe friends, ex-friends, or co-workers I'd never met. There were bound to be a few gossips who might start rumors that Angelina was shacking up with an old boyfriend and would show up eventually. This was no time to be concerned about what others might think. To a point. I tempered the message with people I didn't really know, striking the right balance of urgency without feeding the salacious grapevine. Have you spoken to Angelina today? No. Is something wrong, Abe? I don't know. We're afraid she may have gotten into an accident or something. I knew that was a lie. Even before I came speeding down the street and spotted Angelina's car still in our driveway. I'd run 3 stop signs and 2 red lights since leaving the turnpike. On the grassy swale outside the house were several squad cars parked beside a green and white van from the MDPD Crime Scene Investigation Unit. My car skidded to a stop behind the flashing beacons. Our front door was wide open, and I took it as a positive sign that no ambulance or medical examiner's van was on the scene, confirmation of Santos's earlier report of no body inside. Still, you don't have to be in law enforcement to recognize a cadaver-sniffing dog, and the canine unit was on the scene. Please, please, God, I said softly as I jumped out of the car. My heart was pounding, and I sprinted up the sidewalk, stopping at the yellow police tape in the doorway. Santos was standing in the living room on the other side of the tape, watching over one of the investigators. Has anyone heard from Angelina? I asked, breathless. I had tried Angelina's cell several times for my car with no answer. Santos came one step closer and then stopped, leaving a good 10 feet between herself and the open doorway. No, she said. Where's her mom? One of the officers drove her back to the hotel. We wanted her by the telephone in case Angelina calls a room. That made sense. I glanced around the door jamb and noticed another investigator on his hands and knees with a penlight, combing through the carpeting between the couch and the front door. The broken beer bottle. I had forgotten all about it in my conference call from the car with Ridd, and I'd made no mention of it. I can explain that, I said. Good, but don't come in. I'll be right there. Oh, while I'm thinking of it, can you toss me your car keys? What for? I need to have one of the investigators go through your car. Just standard procedure. You don't mind, do you? If it hadn't come up immediately after the beer bottle, I probably would have minded less. That's fine. I tossed her the keys. Santos headed for the kitchen, our back entrance, and I waited on the front porch for her to walk around the house. My anxiety level was already high, but the thought of having to explain a broken beer bottle sent my stress level skyrocketing. I may have come across as a bit too defensive, but I wanted to address the bottle up front. I stepped down from the porch and met Santos halfway across our front yard. That broken bottle is not from an intruder, I said. How do you know that?
It's mine.
Her expression cut right through me. Is this a tradition in your house? Angelina smashes her wine glasses, you smash your beer bottles?
My mouth fell open.
I had forgotten about the broken wine glass Santos had found by the photographs.
This must look really bad, I said.
Santos was deadpan, no response.
We're not a violent couple, I said.
Throwing bottles across the room is not what we do. It's important for you to know that.
You want to tell me what happened?
Angelina came home around 11 last night. I was on the couch half asleep. Somehow we got into an argument about JT.
What about JT?
Looking after him. It's more of an ongoing discussion and disagreement than an argument. What really set her off was when she found out that I went to Tyler's memorial service.
You didn't tell her before you went?
Her tone was much calmer than Angelina's had been, but it sounded worse coming from an FBI agent.
No.
Carmen asked me to go with her, and I decided at the last minute.
So you told Angelina when she got home?
Well, actually, she saw Carmen and me on television.
So you never even intended to tell Angelina?
No, that's not right.
But she obviously thinks you slept with Tyler.
That's not right either, I said. In fact, the opposite is true. Angelina told me.
She told you what?
The night the photographs came, she told me that she believed me when I said nothing happened between Tyler and me. But now that you say it and seeing how she reacted, maybe that's what Angelina took away from my decision to go to Tyler's memorial service. She lost her temper, told me to get out, and slammed the door. I was outside on the porch when I heard the bottle smash.
Did she hit you at any point?
No.
Did you hit her?
Of course not.
Did she threaten you?
Not really.
Did you threaten her?
No way.
Did she push you?
That question was more difficult. I wouldn't say she pushed me. She took me by the arm, sort of hurrying me to the door.
Did you push back?
Not at all. Look, can we stop making this a domestic violence investigation, please? We know that a serial killer was standing on my front porch 2 days ago, delivering an ash-covered photograph of his latest victim, and now my wife is missing.
I'm not convinced those photos came from Cutter.
But you are convinced that Angelina and I were throwing beer bottles and wine glasses at each other, is that it?
I've seen the broken glass. In Cutter's case, I have yet to see a white victim who wasn't dating a black man.
I was married to a black woman. Who knows how this killer's mind works? And the white woman black man paradigm isn't ironclad anyway. Tyler was a black woman.
It hasn't been confirmed that Tyler was one of Cutter's victims.
My head was starting to spin. Okay, no disrespect to Tyler or any of the other victims, but what the hell is going on here? The clock is ticking, and all we've done so far is talk about a broken beer bottle and the psychological nuances of the Cutter profile. You were the first person Carmen and I agreed we should turn to when Angelina went missing because we thought the FBI would ramp up the search immediately. Are you on board or not?
She was about to say something, but one of the investigators walked over and interrupted.
Agent Santos, could you come inside a moment?
I recognized the investigator.
Early in my career, I had prosecuted a case with her.
Myrna, are you working homicide and missing persons now?
No, she said. I'm still with the domestic crime section.
I recommended the involvement of several units, said Santos. We're covering all bases. I could see which one was first base.
Excuse me, said Santos.
It wasn't clear that I was invited to join them, but my wife was missing. This was our house, and I didn't like the way this was turning.
I followed Santos and the investigator up the driveway. We walked right past my car. The trunk was open, the doors open, the hood up.
The standard investigation apparently involved everything but turning the car upside down and shaking it. We entered the house through the garage and continued down the hall into the living room. Another crime scene investigator held a small piece of broken green glass on an evidence tray, her pen light illuminating the find.
"Looks like blood to me," said the investigator.
Santos examined the specimen more closely. Then her head turned and her gaze fixed right on me.
"Looks like blood to me, too."
It chilled me. But in addition to being a concerned husband, I was a prosecutor who understood how the criminal justice system worked. I felt compelled to say something in my own defense. Maybe Angelina cut herself trying to clean up the broken glass, you know, after I was gone. Santos nodded, but not because she was buying my explanation. It seemed more like the mere expression of her expectation that I would have one.
"Let's get it out to the lab."
Her directive had been to the investigator, but Santos had locked eyes with me.
"And we'll need a cheek swab from you, Mr. Beckham. We need to be able to determine whether this blood or any other DNA we find here belongs to a stranger."
It was a standard request in a missing person case, but her timing made it seem otherwise.
"That's fine," I said.
One of the technicians had her kit ready and came right at my mouth. It took just a few seconds. I looked at Santos and asked, "What's next?"
"I want to continue our discussion outside, with Detective Reyes's involvement," she said, meaning the domestic crimes investigator.
"We're wasting way too much time talking," I said.
"Excuse me?"
"No offense to the team you're assembling, Santos. Domestic crime investigations have their place. But if you're so damn determined to make this into something it's not, I have a ton of things on my to-do list."
"Beckham."
She stopped me as I reached the hallway.
"There's something I find very curious," she said, stepping toward me.
"Curious?"
She nodded, looking me in the eye. We were standing close, and she spoke low enough that no one else could hear. "Now that Angelina has gone missing, you're gripped with fear that Cutter is out there stalking your neighborhood like the boogeyman. But 14 hours ago, you left your wife in this house all alone. How do you explain that?"
I didn't like the implication, and I could feel her studying me, gauging my reaction, taking my criminological pulse. But worse than that, it was a level of guilt I wasn't sure I could ever come to terms with.
"That's quite a bedside manner you've got there, Dr. Santos.
Is this how you talk to every husband with a missing wife?"
"No," she said, her gaze tightening. "Just certain ones."
I tried not to flinch, but I was locking eyes with a pro who had studied far more crime scenes than I ever would.
"I need to find my wife," I said,
then turned and left through the garage, avoiding the broken glass at her front door. I was halfway down the driveway when another investigator stopped me.
"Before you leave, we need to check your hands for gunshot residue. It's standard procedure."
I glanced back toward the house. Agent Santos was watching through the window.
"Of course it is," I said.
Chapter 26. I borrowed our neighbor's car, mine was still being searched, and hit the road. I knew most of Angelina's local hangouts, restaurants, coffee shop, fitness center, and favorite places to shop. I mapped out the circuit in my head, checking each location off one by one. I talked to waitresses, manicurists, personal trainers, and even random persons who happened to be inside when I got there. It took 2 hours. No sign of Angelina, but I did link up with her best friend Sloane, who promised to pull together teams to work the grassroots angle, both in the virtual world of social media and the real world of old-fashioned legwork. By late afternoon, we had 20 volunteers outside my house. I also worked a few connections to bring out the local news stations.
"How do you pronounce your wife's name again?" the reporter asked.
"Is it Angelina, like North Carolina?" We were standing on the sidewalk in front of our house, 30 seconds from going on camera. The squad cars were still parked in the driveway.
Crime scene investigators crisscrossed the yard behind us, coming and going from the house. A line of media vans was parked across the street.
No, it's Angelina, like Lena Horne.
The cameraman was ready. The reporter fixed her hair for the 15th time and smiled.
Not so toothy,
the cameraman said. The poor guy's wife is missing. I was starting to feel like I wasn't even there. Sorry, she said, losing the grin. The cameraman raised his fingers. 3, 2, 1, and we were on the air. Good evening, said the reporter, taking the cue from the anchorwoman in the local studio.
Tonight, law enforcement is looking to help one of its own. I'm standing outside the home of Abe and Angelina...
Lena, I said, Angelina.
Abe and Angelina Beckham, she continued, where a search is underway.
The entire spot lasted 30 seconds. Apart from the mispronunciation, I had no memory of it. I just prayed that they had managed to put up the right picture on television screens across South Florida. I did 3 more interviews, bang, 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 for the other network affiliates. They promised to air it again on the 11 o'clock broadcasts.
Good job, Sloan told me. I was in such a daze that I hadn't even noticed her standing on the sidewalk, watching the television interviews.
Several other friends of Angelina were with her, all wearing comfortable shoes and toting flashlights. Some daylight was remaining, but they looked ready to search all night, if that was what it took. Thanks for coming out, I told her. I expressed the same gratitude to each of Angelina's friends, which went smoothly enough until one of them sniffled back tears and hugged me, saying, I'm so sorry, Abe. I thanked her, even if it was premature for sympathies and condolences, and I could hear the others taking her to task after I turned away. The investigators had already confirmed that Angelina's running shoes were in her closet, but it still seemed worth a shot to trace her route. Maybe she'd caught on to the barefoot running craze. Who knew? Checking somewhere was better than standing around. I didn't know Angelina's jogging route, but Sloan was able to lead me, a handful of volunteers, and one of the MDPD officers on a walk from start to finish. I held my breath a couple of times, but it turned out to be a milk carton in the ditch and the remains of a flattened raccoon on the road. Darkness was falling by the time we finished. I needed a break. But another shot of adrenaline kicked in. I called my mother-in-law at the hotel and offered to bring dinner.
I'll just order room service, said Margaret.
Are you sure?
Yes, she said,
but even her one-word response cracked.
Abe, I'm scared.
It's going to be okay.
This serial killer wasn't news in New York, so I haven't been following the story.
But this sounds like it could be. Margaret, don't go there. We don't know anything yet.
Exactly. We don't know anything. That's what has me so worried. They sent a detective over here to the hotel to get some information on Angelina. He told me that there's been no activity on her cell since late last night. It was her text to me. It's funny. Even after a child is all grown up and married, a mother worries. When Angelina dropped me off at the hotel, I told her to text me to let me know she got home safely, so she did. She texted me and said, she said, I'm home. Love you.
She was starting to unravel. Margaret, I can come by the hotel.
No, no, that's not necessary. But I can't understand this. It's as if Angelina has fallen off the map. The last person to see her was you, and that was 18 hours ago.
Last person to see her. Santos had made the same point while following me out of the house, right up until I jumped in the car to go hunt for Angelina. Let's stay close on this, I said. We'll call each other as soon as we hear anything. Deal?
Okay, deal.
Jake is flying down later tonight. He'll stay with me here at the hotel. Jake was Angelina's father.
That's good. Are Joe and Sandy on their way down?
My parents. I'd called earlier to tell them there was nothing they could do, which was true.
They truly liked Angelina, but things had been awkward between us and Samantha, and I don't mean her death. My parents were too well-mannered to be obnoxious about their disapproval, and they had actually smiled and behaved themselves through the wedding. The tipping point didn't come until about 6 months later, when Samantha and I visited them in Charlottesville and spent the night in their guest room. All was well until we left. 5 miles down the road, I realized that I'd forgotten my sunglasses. I drove back and found that my mother had not only stripped the bed that Samantha and I had slept in, but also thrown the sheets into the garbage. And it wasn't because we'd had sex on them. "Not yet," I said. "They may come later." "Like when? The funeral?" Dumbass thing to say. "Let me know if Jake needs a ride from the airport." "He'll be fine. You should just keep doing what you're doing. I saw the piece you did on the news. That was a..." Her voice faded. I could hear her swallow back her emotions. "Margaret?
Sorry, that interview for the news channel that you did was a good idea."
"Are you sure you don't want me to come by until Jake gets in?"
"No, that's not the best use of your time. Besides, one of your friends is coming to see me. I won't be alone."
"One of my friends? Or one of Angelina's?"
"Yours, Agent Santos."
It was like an ice bath, and I hated that it made me feel that way. The FBI should have been a friend. "Is that what Agent Santos told you, that she was my friend?"
"I'm not sure. Maybe I just assumed. The police officer already took my statement, so I figured that she was just being nice and checking on me. Why is she not your friend?"
"That was complicated."
"She's fine."
"Would you rather I not talk to her?"
The last thing I needed was for my mother-in-law to tell the FBI that I'd instructed her not to talk to the agent who was investigating Angelina's disappearance.
"Not at all," I said. "Just let me know how it goes."
"Okay, I will. Thank you again, Abe. And stay positive."
I promised I would, said goodbye, and hung up. Stay positive was good advice. We had the media involved, the community was activated. All afternoon I'd been fielding calls of support from cops I'd worked with over the years, some of whom had long since retired. Carmen had the entire state attorney's office at my disposal. The Eyewitness News reporter had gotten one thing right. Local law enforcement was mobilized to help one of its own. With one apparent exception. Agent Santos. And it was starting to make me crazy. I needed to get to the bottom of it. It was Saturday night, but Carmen had told me to call any time. I reached out to her. She picked up the phone, but she was attending a banquet at the Four Seasons and was minutes away from accepting another community service award, this one from the Cuban American Bar Association. She promised to stop by my house afterward, which prompted my next move. I started up the sidewalk to check with the crime scene investigators. They seemed to be wrapping things up, but this was taking way too long. If the domestic crime investigator wasn't running the show, she was at least one of its executive producers. I was stepping onto the front porch when I saw Ridd's car pull into the driveway. He jumped out quickly, and the expression on his face as he crossed the lawn gave me concern. I went to him, meeting him halfway, my heart pounding.
"It's okay," he said. "This is not the final piece of bad news that no one wants to hear."
My anxiety level dropped a notch, but it was still high. "We found Angelina's cell phone."
I caught my breath.
"Where?" "On the side of the road. Scuffed up, scratch marks, the glass is shattered. It looks like it was tossed out of a moving car." I went cold. I knew the statistics. I'd attended the police lectures. Never get in the car. Never, never, never kick, scream, punch, squirm, spit, claw. Do whatever it takes, but don't get in that vehicle. A woman's chances of survival plummeted.
"What road?"
I asked. "Calle Ocho," he said, then paused. West End, just before it becomes the Tamiami Trail. The road into the Everglades. I felt my knees buckle. "Dear God," was all I could say. Chapter 27. Victoria was at the Ritz-Carlton having a talk with Angelina's mother when the phone call came from Detective Riddell. She broke things off and drove straight to the recovery scene. Her advice to Margaret was to wait at the hotel. Their conversation had been moving along exactly as Victoria had expected. The last thing the mother of a missing daughter wants to believe is that her model son-in-law is in any way responsible. Difficult questions at this early stage were bound to draw a defensive posture, perhaps even indignation. Extremely difficult questions, like those about the broken beer bottle, could wait for round two. The goal in round one had been simply to open Margaret's mind to possibilities, however unthinkable. It was a 20-minute drive to the Everglades, giving her time aplenty to replay the predictable responses of a distraught mother, and to analyze a few surprises. "When did Angelina ask you to come down from New York?" There were three women in the hotel room. Margaret sat in the armchair by the window. Victoria took the edge of the bed, facing her. Detective Reyes from the Miami-Dade Domestic Crime Section was seated in the desk chair. Margaret was the 70-year-old version of Grace Kelly, and the strong resemblance between mother and daughter made it plain to see how Angelina had become such a classic beauty. The unimaginable stress, however, was already taking a toll. Margaret was holding it together, but barely. A week of this, Victoria knew, and the worry lines would be carved in stone. "Sometime Friday morning was when she called," said Margaret. "When did you get on the airplane?" "Friday afternoon." "What was the rush?" "No rush." "Sounds to me like you got on the first flight available."
"One of the first, I guess."
Was Angelina upset about something?
Of course she was upset.
Angelina is a newlywed. She and Abe had just had their first argument as a married couple. These things happen. I needed to be there for her. "Did she tell you what the argument was about?" Margaret sighed deeply. Her hand shook as she sipped from a glass of water.
"Abe's brother-in-law, JT." "What about him?"
Her voice tightened.
"He scares Angelina. Frankly, he scares me a little too." "Why does he scare you?"
"Why?" asked Margaret. "Have you ever met him?"
"Briefly, at his apartment."
"Well, that's not his apartment. That's where Abe used to live. I don't know all the details, but I understand JT was homeless for a while. You know, he practically ruined Angelina's whole wedding."
"How?"
"He stood up at the reception and made this bizarre toast about Abe being a true brother now because he went from an African-American wife to a blonde. He's a very strange person." "Abe needed to be more sensitive about that."
"Do you think Abe is insensitive?"
"No, not in general, just about this." "Do you think JT could have anything to do with Angelina's disappearance?" She considered the question for quite some time, as if not ruling it out.
"I don't know, but I don't really see how. Isn't he under house arrest?"
"Do you think Abe could?"
"Do I think Abe could what?"
Victoria paused long enough to let Margaret know that she couldn't make the tough questions go away by pretending not to understand them. Then she asked again. "Do you think Abe could have had something to do with Angelina's disappearance?"
"Oh, for God's sake, no. You can't be serious."
Victoria drove west on Southwest 8th Street, past Florida International University, until the lights of strip malls were behind them and the darkness of the Everglades lay ahead.
A night trip on the Tamiami Trail was like a midnight drive across the plains of Kansas. Only the drop-off from civilization was more sudden. The Everglades marked the abrupt end of westward development in city lights, and the chain of headlight beams along the trail stretched like a stray filament into utter blackness. It was the GPS chip in Angelina's smartphone that had led to its recovery. The night search for Angelina was focused on the north side of the trail, the side on which the cell had been found. The staging area for law enforcement's search and recovery mission was the same gravel parking lot used by crews working on the new bridge. Victoria parked beside a colossal earth mover and walked along the shoulder of the road. Detective Reyes was with her. Traffic wasn't any heavier than usual, but it was beginning to back up in both directions. A team of traffic cops kept rubberneckers from bringing the trail to a standstill. Victoria spotted Riddell at the center of activity near a portable tree of vapor lights. A pair of noisy generators powered 6 trees in all, setting the flat waters of the Everglades aglow, but only for a distance of 25 yards or so. A police helicopter whirred overhead, the sweep of its searchlight reaching deeper into the sawgrass. Rescue workers on pontoons trolled slowly across the canal, the beams from high-powered navigation lights crisscrossing in the night. In the darkness beyond, countless pairs of alligator eyes caught just a hint of the artificial light and glowed like fireflies in the darkness. The north side of the trail was for law enforcement only. Police tape stretched for 100 yards along the shoulder. On the other side of the highway, behind a secondary perimeter, stood Abe Beckham. Swirling police beacons turned his face alternating shades of red and orange. Beckham didn't seem to notice Victoria or Detective Reyes as they passed beneath the tape, and they didn't try to get his attention. They went straight to Riddell.
"How goes it?" asked Victoria.
Riddell stepped toward her, away from the noisy generator. "Nothing but a cell phone so far."
"How far are we from the recovery site for Tyler Tompkins?"
"I clocked it. Tompkins was 1 mile and 2/10 due west. It makes a big difference. More shoulder area and dry ground here."
"Any tire tracks or footprints?"
"Yeah, 1 million of them. The work crews walk from the construction staging area to the bridge and back every day. But there's nothing closer to the water. Not a footprint, not a tire track, not a broken weed. Honestly, I don't see this being a recovery site."
"How do you think the phone got here?"
"My take is that the guy got this far down the trail and suddenly remembered that smartphones have GPS tracking chips. He panicked, tossed it out the window, and kept right on going. You can check out the phone for yourself, but it looks like it was thrown from a moving vehicle. I'm hoping that's the case." "Never a good scenario for a woman to be in the car for abductor on the way to who knows where. But she could still be alive."
"She could be," said Victoria.
Riddell glanced farther down the road. Worst case, he drove halfway to Naples before stopping to dispose of the body in the middle of the Everglades. Or he drove to Naples and just kept driving north, maybe with her still alive. Victoria glanced in Abe's direction, then back at Riddell.
"Anything is possible at this point."
"I just issued a bolo for the West Coast from Collier County on up," said Riddell.
"I issued one 6 hours ago," said Santos.
"I know. It's consistent with yours."
"I don't care if it is. You need to coordinate with me. Exactly what did you tell them to be on the lookout for?"
"Here, look for yourself."
He pulled up the bolo on his phone and Victoria read from the screen. "No better than mine," she said. "No worse."
"The situation is what it is," said Riddell. "Other than a photograph of Angelina and your criminal profile of Cutter, white male in his 30s, what else can we say? Angelina's car is still parked in the driveway, so we don't even know what kind of vehicle to look for. Unless, again, we go with the stereotypical serial killer profile and hunt down commercial vans with no windows.
Any thoughts on how to find out what vehicles crossed the trail in the last 24 hours?
Riddell shook his head. There aren't any toll booths on the Tamiami Trail, so no cameras checking plates.
I asked Collier County sheriffs to visit service stations around Naples.
They're talking to sales clerks, checking security cameras. People often stop for gas after a ride across the trail. Maybe something will turn up.
A commotion in the westbound lane caught Victoria's attention. A media van was trying to force its way closer to the crime scene, and traffic cops were doing their job. Many more vans were sure to follow.
We need to work out a press release, said Victoria.
I got it covered, said Riddell.
I'd like to see it.
He hesitated.
Before you issue it, she said, unlike the bolo.
Riddell glanced over his shoulder toward his friend Abe, then gave Victoria a stern expression.
Let me say this up front. We all know the statistics on married women murdered by their husbands, and I felt a certain vibe coursing through Abe's house tonight. But at this point, I don't say a damn thing to even hint that Abe Beckham is in any way, shape, or form under a cloud of suspicion. Period.
Victoria neither agreed nor disagreed. Communication with the media is a task force function. I need to see it.
He locked eyes with her a moment, as if to reemphasize that certain things were not negotiable.
It's in my car. I'll get it.
Victoria waited on the side of the road with Detective Reyes, both women watching the search and rescue team at work. Reyes broke the silence.
I agree with Riddell, she said.
There was almost an apologetic quality to the detective's voice. Victoria's gaze remained fixed, cast out toward the Everglades. She said nothing.
Abe is a stand-up guy, Reyes continued. I've worked with him. He's highly respected.
He's also a liar, said Victoria. He had an affair with Tyler Tompkins. He lied to his wife about it.
He lied to his boss about it with me in the room.
We don't even know for sure that he was having an affair.
For sure? As in 100% certain?
No.
And Tyler is dead, so we may never know.
Even if he was having an affair, that doesn't make him a murderer.
No, but it explains a lot.
Angelina gets the photos of Abe with Tyler. She calls her mom down from New York. She comes home from dinner, only to hear that while she and her mother were trying to figure out how to save her marriage, Abe went to his lover's memorial service. She tells him to get out, the marriage is over, they argue, a beer bottle sails across the room, one thing leads to another, and when it's over, Abe has a dead body on his hands. He tosses Angelina's cell phone on the Tamiami Trail to make us think Cutter did it. God only knows where he dumped Angelina's body.
Lots of suppositions in there.
Be honest, said Victoria. Many a model husband has jumped to the top of your list of suspects based on far less than this.
I would be more in your camp if we had a history of domestic violence.
Two nights ago,
I found a broken wine glass on their cocktail table.
That's not what I mean.
Nothing I heard from Angelina's mother even raised the possibility of an abusive relationship.
Mom lives in New York. She knows what her daughter wanted her to know.
We need to focus on local witnesses. Angelina's girlfriends?
They're on the list.
But I'm going to break the mold here.
Start where Abe wouldn't expect me to start.
Where's that?
Victoria checked her watch.
Only 9. Still early. Time enough to follow another lead.
A twofer, she said. The only person with a front row seat in both of Abe's marriages. Reyes thought for a moment.
You don't mean his brother-in-law, do you?
Victoria's expression turned very serious.
That's exactly